But there are people who are willing to say, no, this is not right. And those people, even if they're in a minority, are absolutely important. And they are what gives the crooked timber its strength. Yes.
Hello and welcome to this Short Fiction Masterclass, brought to you by Thresholds, the International Short Story Forum, in collaboration with the Charleston Trust. My name is Jack Catania, and I shall be talking to the novelist and short story writer Patina Gappar about her brand new collection, Rotten Row. Today we're going to explore the voices of Zimbabwe, method writing, Victorian morality, Marx, religion, and being on the outside, looking in.
Welcome and thank you for talking to us today. I've been privileged to receive an advanced copy of your next short story collection, Rotten Row, which is due to be published in November. In it, you experiment with different approaches to storytelling. For example, the court judgment, an autopsy report, an internet discussion forum, as well as other voices. And I was hoping that you could read us the introduction to one of these stories, The News of Her Death.
Thank you very much, Jack. I'm very pleased to be here. And I'm going to read from The News of Her Death, and because it's the beginning, it doesn't need any setup. By the time Pepukai emerged from the combi at Highfield, it had gone just 8:30. She was 30 minutes late. Kindness had said she'd come at 8, or just before. She had followed the directions in the text message. Take combi to Machipisa, get off at Kwanzura, cross road, walk past Mushangira Pangwe Hotel, go left after TM, go past market, saloon, that is how Kindness had spelled it, is next to butcher. She found the salon with no problems. The name Snow White Hairdressing appeared below a painting of a woman with hair that flowed and curled into the letters around her. From the butchery next door came the whirring sound of a saw on bone. Everything about the salon spoke of distressed circumstances. The peeling paint outside, the worn chairs and dirty walls inside, the faded posters for Dark and Lovely and Motion's Hair Relaxers. Snow White Hairdressing made her usual place in Finsbury Park look like the Aveda in Covent Garden. Then again, none of the Nigerian and Kenyan women at a salon in London would have done her hair in long thin braids that lasted 4 months and cost only $50. If they had, it would have cost £500 and lasted 2 days or more if she was lucky.
Thank you. That's a great introduction to a story.
Thank you.
It really sets it up well. And I'm interested in Pepukai because she is a character that reappears in some of the first part of your short story collection. Yeah, she's the point of view character. In all familiar faces, she's walk-on part. And in A Kind of Justice, she's almost the narrator, even though it's third person. So tell me about Pepukai.
Yeah, you know, I'm heavily and very strongly influenced by J.M. Kassir, the wonderful South African writer, who incidentally gave me a very kind blurb for my first book, and he really helped me to open quite a few doors. And I'm interested in the way that he never writes about himself, but he has this persona that he hides behind in his fiction. And he uses that persona to be very brutally self-assessing in a way. And so if you look at Boyhood, you look at Youth, and you look at Summertime, it's the J.M. Kassir persona who appears throughout. And in a way, it's a way of him owning his own life.
Yes.
Because there will be Kassir autobiographies, Kassir biographies written. But this is him saying, this is me examining myself very closely. And so if you find a Pepukai in a story, in a way, it's a clue that it's a story about me.
About you.
And about my own doubts, the questions I have about the world, and the many insecurities I suffer as not just a person or as a lawyer or whatever. And Pepukai actually has another name as well. She's got two names, like most Zimbabweans. She's got an English name and a Shona name.
Yeah.
And her English name is Emily.
Mm-hmm.
So the first real Pepukai story is in my first book, An Elegy for Easterly.
Okay.
When we find Emily in the annex, which is the mental wing of the main hospital in Harare.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much based on an experience I actually had. And I really wanted to write about that experience, but I didn't want to write as myself.
Yes.
So I created this persona of Emily.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I was writing these stories, I realized that Emily was Pepukai.
Mm-hmm.
So I did something in one of the stories later that explained why she has two names, mm-hmm. you know. So every time you see an Emily story or a Pepukai story, it's a story about me.
It's a story about
and
you.
And it's a story about a real thing that happened to me. Just like this story of this woman who's murdered by her boyfriend is a story that I heard when I went to get my hair done mm-hmm. about 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just such an extraordinary day because it's all that the hairdressers could talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And the story grew legs as mm-hmm. the afternoon grew longer, you know. And it kept being exaggerated and added to, and people would come in and out of the salon and they would repeat, you know, the story of how this woman had died. It's very differently, by the way, to how she actually dies in the fictional story.
Yes.
But I found it really interesting, the idea of a story that grows and grows and grows in exaggeration.
Yes.
And in a way, it's why I used the Mark Twain quote as the title.
Mm-hmm.
The news of my death has been greatly exaggerated. So it's called the news of my death.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a story, it's about gossip and rumour, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
But it's also about the violence that is the backdrop of your characters' lives.
It's a violence that's so casual and casually accepted.
Yes.
And what I found really interesting, listening to those gossiping women in the salon, was how they accepted that this woman's life could only have ended in this way.
Mm-hmm.
That she had somehow invited the yes. violence on herself. Because she was double-crossing her boyfriend, you know. And it's something that I found really shocking and very upsetting to understand that part of the reasons that domestic violence is accepted in Zimbabwe
mm-hmm.
is because a lot of the women really believe
mm-hmm.
that maybe not themselves, but other women
deserve it. Other women deserve it,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a distancing mechanism or a protection mechanism.
Exactly.
Almost, isn't it?
Like, it wouldn't happen to me because I'm virtuous. Mm-hmm. This, but yeah, it happened to her because she was double-crossing mm-hmm. her boyfriend. And I want to write the kind of stories that are real, that are true, and that feel true. So I try very hard not to run away from ugliness.
Mm.
And one of the ugly truths about Zimbabwe is that it's women who are at the vanguard of the patriarchy.
Mm.
It's women who sometimes very actively defend patriarchal interests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both because they do it for self-protection
mm.
and also because some of them really believe in these very rigid roles, these very rigid gender roles.
Yeah.
That men are like this, women are like this. And women have the duty to guard their virtue.
Yes.
And if they don't guard their virtue, other women will tell them, you know.
Mm.
So it's a very Victorian
yes.
kind of mentality. Yes. And we were colonized by the Victorians.
Yes.
And I'm sorry to say, we still have a lot of those Victorian attitudes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Mm. And I think it's interesting because Pepukai is coming in, she's very much a woman, but she's also able to look from the outside. It's that role, and this is why I wondered if she was you, that role of belonging but not belonging.
That's precisely it, and it's such a great observation, because Pepukai is able to be more distanced precisely because she has left. So she's very much in the culture, in the society, but at the same time she's looking at it
mm.
in a slightly more refracted way.
Yes.
You know, she's a little bit more outside the situation. And it's definitely my take on Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
I love Zimbabwe. I love everything about Zimbabwe. I love the language. I love the culture. I love the humor. I love the resilience. But I also see things about Zimbabwe that really perplex me and that mm-hmm. disturb me. And that, to be honest, I might not have seen if I had not left.
No.
Yeah.
It's that mm-hmm. looking from the outside in.
Precisely.
And then from the inside out as well.
Yeah. yeah. I've got a friend who said that my travel memoir should be called Abroad.
We'll come to the humour in your stories in a moment. But I'd like to just think a little bit about A Kind of Justice, which you said was one of your favourite stories, which is also a Pepukai story. And in it she asks, what is it about us that these are our lives? Yeah, her field is transitional justice.
Yeah.
And you paint this character as someone who was initially idealistic, but she'd come to accept that the only power she had, if she had any at all, was that of witness. And there's quite a hard read in this story. There's a cataloguing of terrible torture and horrors and killings. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the role of writer as witness.
Yeah. That story is... I had a lot of second thoughts about whether to include it or not. It's one of the stories, together with the news of her death, that came to me from way back in my past. I had a boyfriend, my son's father, my ex, who was a lawyer in Sierra Leone. He's an international criminal law expert. And I went to visit him and spent about a month in Sierra Leone, seeing the court, attending trials, and just talking to people, because when I travel, I love to talk to people. And the question that really bothered me was, why did this happen? Why did this happen in Sierra Leone? What was it about Sierra Leone that made it a powder keg for this horrible violence? So I talked to a lot of people, ordinary people, experts, and I still, you know, it's still something that perplexes me, just like, you know, Rwanda disturbs me. Any sort of site of violence is extremely disturbing. And then, of course, the common link, you know, the Congo, same thing, is that these are African conflicts.
Yeah.
And you can understand them intellectually. You can understand, oh, the Conference of Berlin in 1885, Bismarck sat down and they drew
the straight lines across Africa,
splitting families asunder, nations asunder. And you can understand
that shouldn't be together. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's a line that is in there that she understood that these old hatreds were being played out against the staccato of modern weapons. And I understand that. And I understand all the arguments. I understand slavery. I understand colonialism. I understand Walter Rodney, how Europe underdeveloped Africa. But that doesn't take away the pain.
Yeah.
So to me, the story was, how do you address the pain? And you can intellectualize your way out of it, but the pain is still there. So this is Pepukai's central question. Why is it that these are our lives?
Yes.
And she has no answers.
Yeah.
And because she has no answers, she can only witness.
She can only witness.
And that's why in another story, which is going to come out in another collection, we're going to see Pepukai moving away from being a lawyer to being a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
And that becomes
the beginning in this story.
Exactly. And so she now wants to, because she understands all of the legal arguments, she wants to focus on the impact, the result, the feelings arising from all these conflicts. And so she decides that her job is to be some kind of witness. Yeah.
And that did strike me, that you are a lawyer and that you've chosen to witness as a writer.
As a writer, exactly. Exactly, yeah. Very excellent and intelligent reading, I have to say.
But there's also a lot of humour in this collection, even in the story where somebody's about to be murdered. And we told right at the beginning of the story in Copacabana, the poor kids are going to get murdered. So we're waiting for it to happen. And while we're waiting, you enchant us with such exuberant language. You know, there's this dialogue, which is a blend of different languages and slang. And you've echoed Chinua Achebe, I think, in another interview, saying, "Let no one be fooled by the fact that we may write in English, for we intend to do unheard of things with it."
I love that quote.
Indeed. So to illustrate, please, could you read us an extract from Copacabana?
I'm very happy to. Copacabana is set in a kombi. The kombi is what is called in East Africa the matatu, which is this really uncomfortable public transport vehicle. Normally there's supposed to be 12 people, but somehow they managed to squeeze in 24. And the lord of the kombi is the windy. They're very loud, they're very talkative, and they have power over you while you're in the vehicle. So this story is the story of a windy called Giza. Giza bangs the roof to stop the van. "Copacabana! Copacabano! Copacabano!" Two passengers jump out to be replaced by three more. The kombi moves off again in a cloud of petrol and exhaust fumes. Among the new passengers is a young woman in a bright red top and leopard print skirt. She wears a perfume of such pungency that it almost defeats the exhaust fumes that fill the van. As she gets in, Giza clutches his heart in mock shock. He says, as it pushes against the man in the front seat next to him to let her pass. It is the same passenger with whom he has already collided. He stumbles and collapses into the man. "Sorry, Jagare, big dada. Sorry, Ndinemi," he says as he brushes past the man's jacket pocket. He turns back to the woman and says, "Sister, as smart as you are, where are you off today?" "Sisivaka feka mbada kungedindingwe." Handika kupungwe, kushika kwa tingwe. The woman ignores him and takes out her mobile phone as it rings.
I'll call you later, she says. I'm going to Burldale.
Mukoma Prosper, did you hear this leopardess of ours? Shouts Giza. Sisri mbada wa noza wena. What did she say? Says Prosper. Burldale. She said Burldale. Did you mean Burldale? She's going to Burldale. This is what we mean when we say someone is talking like they're chewing water. Burldale, she says. Too embarrassed to be associated with us. Maybe one day, if you're very lucky, sister, you will have a shiny car to match your accent. Then you won't have to use combis like you're one of us povo. Burldale. Hella. But I bet that if I stepped on your right foot right now, or even your left one, you would say, my way, like Mkoma Prosper. Oh, mama wami, like me. Not all my mummy. Burldale. Hey. His body out of the window once again, he shouts, Copacabana. As he settles back in, he says, Eish. But you smell so nice. Hey, she smells so nice and come up Prosper. The guy's Jacobati very sister in Badilo. I can smell her from here, Prosper says. Giza sings.
Dire agent fire sand kanganisa. Chinamira tarira mandrazino shereketa. Kunge kutsombora tsombo kana kutakura dombo.
In the second row, an old woman lets out a sneeze that startles the stony-faced babe into crying. My way, sister, Giza says in mock horror. Look what you've done. This poor old man is sneezing, and that baby is crying, and it's all from your perfume. Maybe it is the ancestral spirits that do not like modern times. Shukai jenyu bo kules.
Thank you. That's wonderful. I could hear your voice when I was reading it.
I'm so glad you made me read that passage, because it's such a playful exchange, and this is exactly how Windies talk. I spend a lot of time on public transport, and it's always about the song of the moment, the music of the moment, because combis are where you hear the latest songs. So the song that he sings, and I got permission to quote it in full, thanks to Jab Praiser, and the third generation is one of the hottest stars. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the Jay-Z of Zimbabwe right now. And the first thing he says, he's from another really hot guy called Toki Vibes. So this is the language of the street.
Yes.
That people incorporate pop cultural references.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they bring into their language popular things that are actually going on at the moment. Yeah. Yes,
because I think you've said this combi is like a site for storytelling.
It's precisely.
When stories happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you're writing this dialogue, does it just come to you? Do you collect it and then use it? How does it emerge? How do these voices emerge?
Because I'm very interested in the way people actually talk. And I always cite Zadie Smith as my greatest influence in that respect, because she has a brilliant ear for dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because she's a very good listener.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to be a good listener. I was saying earlier that I'm very chatty, but I also try to listen a lot. And I'm also very... I'm a very good mimic, I want to believe, and I'm not giving credit to myself. I have to give credit to my mother,
mm-hmm.
because it's a skill that all her children inherited.
Uh-huh.
And the mimicry comes out in different forms. My sister, my brother are very good actors. I've got a sister who can dance like anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she can mimic anyone in dance. And my mimicry comes out on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very good at that kind of ventriloquism.
Mm-hmm.
I can take on anybody's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I have I had a wonderful workshop with a Canadian author called Eunice Scarf. And she taught me a very important lesson. Before you send anything out to be published,
mm-hmm.
read it out loud.
Yeah. Yes.
And not only does it, you know, take away a lot of typos and mistakes and things like that, but I want to write dialogue that feels natural.
Mm-hmm.
And so I rehearse a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also have a very captive audience in my brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I read them things that I'm writing, and they give me comments. So it's really something that I pay a great deal of attention to.
I think that comes through on the page, actually.
Yeah. And I've learned something from Helen Simpson, who was a dear friend and one of my favorite writers, that you should always carry... Because I always carry a notebook anyway, but she actually carries a specific notebook in which she writes down snatches of conversation mm-hmm. that she hears. Because she's another really brilliant writer, dialogue. So I've taken up that tip, and now I carry a notebook everywhere, and I write mm-hmm. down little things that I hear. Yeah.
It's more than idiomatic. It's the kind of creative use of language.
Yes. Yeah, no, thank you for that. Yeah. One of my favorite moments was in a department store in Geneva, and two women were looking at bags, and I walked past them. And one woman says to the other, "If I had known she really liked him, I would never have done anything."
Wow, there's a story.
There's a story right there.
And airports. Mm. Oh, airports are great. Mm. You know, that there's something about English mothers, you know, the... And I'm talking about for English middle-class mothers, the very loud parenting that they do. Theodore, say thank you to the man. Say thank you to the man. It's brilliant. I love traveling. I love being at airports. Mm. And I just love listening in on conversations. And in the very specific context of Zimbabwe, I really try very hard to imagine myself as the characters I'm writing. I once said to a friend that I'm a method writer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you know, Robert De Niro. I sort of inhabit a character, and then I, yeah.
Which is really interesting, because that leads me on to asking you about point of view, because some of your stories are told from quite an omniscient point of view.
Mm.
Like the old familiar faces, it's somebody telling us about these people. We don't really get into their heads. Sometimes we write in somebody's head.
Yeah.
That's a good example. Sometimes you write in the first person.
Yeah. I'm trying to be a more accomplished writer.
Mm.
I'm trying to get to middle-marsh levels of accomplishment, because I think that, to me, is the ultimate authorial voice.
Mm.
That omniscient author who is in complete control of everything in the story and who is able to inhabit each character's head at different times. And that's what, you know, George Eliot does so much. And there's a wonderful passage where she tells you how guilty she is that she has spent so much time on Dorothea, you know, and she's so interested in all of her subjects, in all her people, even the small ones. And that's what I want to get. I've only achieved that voice twice. The first time in my first book, An Elegy for Italy, in the title story.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time in this book, in a story called Washington's Wife Decides Enough is Enough. It's that sort of George Eliot meets Jane Austen, Miss Edith Wharton in Zimbabwe. That's my ideal voice. That's the real me, you know, as a writer. That's the sort of like detached, wry, amused, but not mocking.
Yes,
you know,
amused but not mocking is
exactly
a good way of describing it.
Yeah, whereas Anna Boniface and the old familiar faces, there's a mockery there.
Yes,
right. I'm sort of like laughing at these characters, and it's amusing. It's funny. It's an artifice, if you like. But I'm not nearly as satisfied with that point of view and that voice as I am with the more sort of grand.
Mm.
Yeah. And in a way, I'm in training for my big novel about Zimbabwe, which is an epic that starts in 1940 and ends in 2018. And it's written in that voice.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been experimenting and trying out different things because I wanted to sort of like brush away all the cobwebs and really focus on writing in that particular voice, because that, I think, is the real me as a writer.
I do enjoy it when you adopt, say, a first-person narrative from a male point of view, because I think that's really daring.
That's fun.
Like, men are
so easy.
Yes, but not so much. I mean, you've done a first-person plural in Zaka the Zulu, which really works.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful quotation from you when Zaka the Zulu was published in the New Yorker, wasn't it?
Yes.
And there's a wonderful quotation from you where you say, "I don't believe in the write what you know school of writing. I believe in writing what I can realistically imagine." So I think there's that sort of sense of you are able to do that projection into other characters' heads.
That's so lovely that you quote that, because I feel very strongly about it, especially in view of all this discussion about cultural appropriation and so on, because I think ultimately, those arguments come down to whether something is good or not.
Yes.
And, you know, something is good if the author, the writer, has taken time and care, consideration, if necessary to do research, has done the appropriate research, has really tried to imagine themselves, really put themselves in the feet of a particular character. And so it is the character that you care about.
Yes.
It's not the author or the writer of that character.
Or who the character represents in terms of race and gender.
Yeah, and that's one of the... It's such a hard one because there are so few writers from Africa generally, from Zimbabwe in particular, who make it to the world stage. So the temptation to be read as a writer who's representative of Zimbabwe, my people and so on, is very strong. And I appreciate that it comes mainly from a very liberal viewpoint that wants an inclusive world and diversity and all the rest of it. But I'm really not a representative for anyone. I just happen to be writing about Zimbabwe right now because that's what interests me. But my next two books are set outside Zimbabwe completely. Mm-hmm. So who am I representing there?
Exactly.
So I am a writer, first and foremost. And then I have different subjects. At the moment, my subject is Zimbabweans, Zimbabweans. I very grandly call my first three books the first Zimbabwe trilogy. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping there'll be a second Zimbabwe trilogy. But after Rotten Row, I am moving out of contemporary Africa completely, never mind Zimbabwe, and I'm writing a historical novel. And after that, I'm writing a series of stories set in the twisted world of an international organization in Geneva, you know. And then after that, who knows, I might write a dystopia set in post-Brexit. It actually is pretty much a bit of a dystopia right now, but that's my own prejudices. I feel very strongly about just being a writer. I think it was Aminata Fauna, who's absolutely brilliant. She's an author who's Scottish and Sierra Leonean. And she says that it's only white male writers who have the privilege of being just writers.
Exactly.
Everybody else is qualified.
Exactly.
You know, everybody else is qualified. And I really want to get to the point of being an unqualified writer. And so for me, it's also not just my own personal enjoyment and challenge and satisfaction, but it's also really important politically for me to write in as many diverse voices as I possibly can.
Yeah,
one of my favorite stories actually is in the voice of a Rhodesian hangman, because I wanted to write about the death penalty, but I didn't want to write from my own liberal prejudices, because I'm deathly, can I say that, deathly opposed to the death penalty.
Yes.
But I wanted to write it from the point of view of somebody who actually kills people for a living. What must that be like, you know? And there's only ever been, I think, two hangmen born on Zimbabwean soil, and they've both been white. There's never been a black Zimbabwean hangman. So if I wanted to write a realistic story about a hangman, he could only be a Rhodesian, you know? So that, in a way, the subject dictated the voice.
So, Rotten Row is described as exploring the causes and effects of crime, and it's a meditation on the nature of justice. But its moral dimension is really clear. It's got a really strong moral dimension, because if you're talking about crime, if you're talking about justice, you're also talking about some kind of morality. And it really interested me that you had biblical quotations in front of every single story, in front of each section. The first section is capital, the second section is crime. You've got a quotation from Kant and a quotation from Marx.
My two favourite philosophers.
Yes. And the Marx one is actually a comment on religion.
Yeah.
It's a comment on religion. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of the heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. But each story is preceded by a quotation in English from the Bible, followed by the Shona translation. Could you tell me what the intertextuality is doing? What's the relationship of the quotation to the story, to the narrative?
Again, that's such a great question, really well observed. Let me talk first about Kant and Marx. If everything goes my way, and I'm moving to Berlin next year, I actually want to do a course in German philosophy, because I think the German philosophers are just some of the most interesting. And Kant and Marx in particular have really shaped the way I certainly understand the world. And I love that quotation from Kant that it's crooked timber, isn't it? That's the nature of... That's what it is to be man. You're crooked, you're flawed, you're twisted in some way. And the Marx quotation is something that I've thought a lot about, and I didn't have the right words to express it. Marx was an atheist. I'm an atheist. And he puts into words my understanding of religion. I'm not an atheist in the Richard Dawkins, angry atheist who hates religion kind of way. I'm an atheist who loves religion. I was brought up by religious parents, went to religious schools. I voluntarily became a Catholic. I became a Buddhist at the age of 17, felt lonely after 3 months, and eventually found Marxist-Leninism, and that became my religion until I met my first boyfriend, and then he became my religion. But, you know, the Marx quote that people know about religion is the first part of that quotation, which is, religion is the opiate of the poor, right? But he goes on to say, It is the heart of a heartless world and the soul of soulless conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, he understands why the poor need religion, right? It's a way to express and to explain their suffering. It's a way that gives hope to the very poor that maybe it's not about this world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mask, it's armor. Religion is armor, especially in a place like Zimbabwe. And I found it really striking that people have become more fervent in their religious beliefs since the economy started collapsing.
Yeah.
So a very strong link there. And the most influential and most powerful people in Zimbabwe right now are the Pentecostal pastors because they promise prosperity through prayer.
Yeah.
And it's a very seductive message. And I've spent a lot of time going to different churches, and I completely understand how seductive that message is. But at the same time, the Christianity of Zimbabwe is not really the Christianity of the Bible. It's not really the Christianity of Christian charity, suffer the little children. So I wanted to contrast a society that proclaims its belief in Jesus so very strongly in every single word, in every single Facebook post. At the same time, it's got all these violent crimes, especially against vulnerable people, against children, against women. Mm. So there's this weird hypocrisy at the heart of it. And the reason I chose those particular Bible texts is I wanted the Bible as it first arrived in Zimbabwe, which was the King James, beautiful, beautiful version of the Bible. And the first Shona Bible was translated at Morgenstern Mission and published in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those two texts that precede each story. And I looked for particular, I know my Bible really well, I looked for particular texts on justice.
Yes.
You know, to sort of contrast how the Bible understands justice and how Zimbabweans, at least not all Zimbabweans, but how the Zimbabwean society is twisting the notion of justice.
Mm.
Is that a very long answer? Sorry.
That's a perfect answer. Thank you. And really interesting, because that was the sense that I got. It wasn't a direct message. It wasn't a direct moral in the story. It's very rich. It's very layered.
I'm so glad you say that, because I like the question you have on moral clarity. I mean, I feel very strongly about crime, particularly because of my legal training and also because I'm a humanist. But at the same time, I didn't want to preach.
Yes.
You know, I really didn't want to wag the finger. But I just wanted to point and say, look at this.
Yes.
Look at this mismatch. Look at this utter hypocrisy. So the story I read from earlier, the news of her death, these women are gossiping about this woman. In Shona, the word is kuchera, which means to really dig. They're digging into her character, into her reputation. And then in the middle of it all, they get up and pray. And, you know, receive our sister kindness into your loving arms, Father. She has gone to meet a heavenly maker. And then they stop praying, and then they're digging into her again.
Yeah.
There's no idea that Christian is an active thing that you live.
It's an ideology.
Exactly. Mm. And it's really that, honestly, I cannot have a better word for it. It's that Victorian thing of appearances. You know,
yes.
Appearances that are not actually reflected in people's conduct. Just as the Victorians had more brothels than at any time in England's history, Zimbabwe, despite our one man, one wife belief, we have more small houses than ever at any point in our history. You know, so it's that sort of like hideous hypocrisy that I'm fascinated by.
The appearances. But there are moments of redemption, nonetheless. Yes. There are moments of redemption.
Yes.
One of the moments of redemption is in your final story, which is Ladies and Gentlemen, Bob Marley and the Wailers. And I think there's a great paragraph in that story where your point of view character, who's called Samson, who's a journalist, thinks about the headlines. Mm. And the headlines he feels always rejig. They're always the same headlines. But he says it's in the stories, in the text, that the tragedy of the nation unfolds.
Mm.
And then you summarise some of the things that have been the subject, the stories. So would you like to read that paragraph?
Yes. It was not the headlines, but in the fine print, that the full tragedy unfolded. It was in the stories that unfolded at Rotten Row that the fate of the nation was written large. A man at Chitubu had been knifed because he had taken more than his fair share from a container of opaque beer. A woman who lived with a stepchild had cut long thin marks into the little girl's arms because she laughed in her sleep. a combi tout accused of stealing a phone had been beaten to death by a crowd at Copacabana. A man accused of having a pet snake that rested under his car had been beaten unconscious on Leopold Takawira. A hairdresser, knifed by her boyfriend at Northfield's penthouses, had died from her wounds. A victim of political violence had refused to say dead and buried in Gokwe. A small house had seduced a madman to harvest his semen. An identified corpse had been found at Golden Quarry. A fight had broken out in Bari over the rumored news of the president's death. These were the stories Samson listened to and wrote up every day at Rotten Row.
Samson himself, who is going to be part of the whole fabric of this by selling naked pictures of Diliwe, who was his sometime lover, goes to beauty pageant. He's hoping that she will actually win, or at least come in one of the top three places, so that the
pictures are more valuable. Yeah,
sell the pictures. And then he has some kind of change of heart. He hears her sing, and he deletes the pictures on his phone.
I call it very pretentiously, he has the sudden radiance of unexpected love. He falls in love with her, and he realizes he can't do it. And I really wanted to end the collection on a hopeful note, that there are many, many opportunities that Zimbabweans, people everywhere in the world, you come cross to doing something unspeakable and then you hold back. And those are the people I admire the most. The people who come right to the edge of the abyss and then they pull back. And that's why one of the things I love is the quotation from the Bible that precedes that story, which says, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, and if there be any praise, think on those things." I really love that.
Yeah.
If we could have that kind of Christianity, I would be very happy to be one of them.
Yes. And it's funny because Mafa, who's in The Death of Wonder, he's not a religious man. He says he's not a religious man. He says he's an atheist.
Yeah.
But right at the end, he too has a point where he doesn't go beyond. He says every man has his sticking point, and this is mine.
Mm.
He refuses to sanction the giving over of a bride.
Yeah, to appease.
To appease the relatives of a murdered man. That really moved me because of the character, because of who he was. He was a man who took bribes, and suddenly he had a point that he wouldn't go beyond. And no, I also saw that as redemption.
He's based on a policeman I know who, you know, when you give him a bit of whiskey, he'll say, "I can take a traffic bribe. I can take $10, $20, but I don't do rape." I don't do rape. He will not accept a bribe when it comes to rape accusations.
Yeah.
And to me, that was just like, wow, you know, the idea that there's a line that you don't cross.
Yes.
I think is very, very important.
It's important in these stories as well.
Yeah.
I think.
That there's a line that you can't cross. Yeah.
And I think it kind of answers my final question, which I was going to ask you. Despite all the horror, is there hope for the crooked timber of humanity?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Because timber is strong.
Yes.
You know, it's crooked, but it's resilient. There's a wonderful quote from Ian McEwan. It's something like, "Lovely, flawed humans."
Yes.
You know, we are terribly, terribly flawed. But there's that instinct to goodness. You know, that there's that will to overcome our base nature. And even though you have a society like Zimbabwe, where it seems that those of a baser nature have taken over, there are enough people to keep reminding them, "Hey, this is not who we are." And to me, that gives me great, great hope. It gives me great hope because it means that there are people who are able to imagine a different way.
Thank you, Katina. That was a wonderful talk.
Thank you so much
for your insight and your generosity.
This is my first interview to promote this book, and it's such a lovely way to start. Thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. Thank you. Yeah.